This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moskowain. In most U.S. states, parents can refuse vaccinations for their children for religious and philosophical reasons. That issue came to light recently when there was a measles outbreak. News reports showed schools and kindergartens with a sizable number of unvaccinated students. Our guest, Paul Offit, is one of the country's most outspoken and high-profile proponents of vaccines. He's a professor of pediatrics in the Department of Infectious Diseases, also director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine. His new book, Bad Faith, is about what he calls religiously motivated medical neglect. The book includes heartbreaking stories of children who have died of curable diseases because their parents chose to use their faith instead of modern medicine. Offit also believes that Jesus' love for children is a message to people of faith about the importance of providing for their medical care, something we will talk about in this hour of Radio Times. Paul Offit's other books include Vaccinated, Autism's False Prophets, Deadly Choices, Do You Believe in Magic? And Paul Offit, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You keep coming back to this issue. Do you feel like you're winning or losing this battle?
I think we're winning this battle. I think ultimately good science prevails, and I think ultimately society cares about its children. So I think we're winning.
Do you understand the suspicion that some people have of science and of medicine, knowing that medicine has not been perfect? It has made mistakes in the past. It is, you know, it has touted things that have ended up hurting, sometimes even killing people.
Yeah, well, I think sort of scientists get it wrong all the time. But science, I think, ultimately is enormously self-correcting. I mean, there was a paper in the early 80s claiming that excess coffee drinking increased your risk of pancreatic cancer. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, great journal. It was published by an epidemiologist at Harvard, great university and medical center. And it was wrong, dead wrong. And ultimately, I think science showed that that was wrong because it was irreproducible. So I think science gets it right, whereas scientists don't necessarily get it right. And I think people confuse those two.
Well, and just picking up on that, and we have done shows with you about vaccines, but even Andrew Wakefield's now discredited study about autism and vaccines, that was published in The Lancet. I mean, The Lancet is a very prestigious journal of medicine and science.
Yeah, the oldest of the general medical journals. And so people thought this must have been vetted. It wouldn't be published here unless it wasn't. In fact, actually, four of the six people who reviewed that paper argued to reject it, but the editor-in-chief sort of took it upon himself to publish it anyway. But again, science wins out because mm-hmm. it stands on the strong pillar of reproducibility, and that was an irreproducible study.
But at the same time, you know what it created in the sort of wake of that original study.
Oh, that virus, that paper killed children. I mean, there were four children in England died because their parents chose not to vaccinate them because they feared the vaccine more than the disease. And so I think it did an enormous amount of harm.
What got you interested in faith and medicine, religion and medicine?
I lived through the 1991 measles epidemic in Philadelphia, an epidemic that centered on two fundamentalist churches in the city, Faith Tabernacle and First Century Gospel. There were 1,400 cases of measles in our city in a few-month period. There were 9 children who died, 6 in that community and in that church community, and then 3 in the surrounding communities as the virus spread. And, you know, we saw some of these children in our hospital. We admitted more than 40 children and saw about 200 in our emergency department. And it was remarkable to me that parents would be willing to stand back and watch their children suffer, thus trumping, I think, their most basic primal instinct, which is to protect your child.
And this was a case, you know, almost, 25 years ago here in Philadelphia. But it sounds sort of oddly familiar as I read about it. Or reread about it in your book.
Right. Sadly, yes. I mean, there are, you know, about 30,000 parents who choose not to vaccinate their children for religious reasons. There are tens of thousands of people in this country who choose not to give their children medical care for religious reasons. And there are some rituals in religion that actually put children at risk. And I guess that just is what interested me. One, why do parents let it happen? And two, why does the law let it happen?
Well, in fact, your book begins with a story of another Philadelphia story, a family, Schaible, is that how you pronounce her
name? Schaible.
Schaible, who had actually 2 children die.
Right, and which I think probably underlines just how tragic these stories can be. I mean, here are parents who, when their 2-year-old had bacterial pneumonia, chose prayer instead of antibiotics. And the way that our legal system handled that was to give them a slap on the wrist, to give them probation, knowing that these were parents who had the potential to not seek out medical care in children for their children who were desperately ill. They had a number of other children. And so then what happened was a few years later, they denied antibiotics for a second child who had bacterial pneumonia. They chose prayer instead, and then that child died. And then and only then did they get a prison sentence. Then and only then were their children taken away and put in foster care. So that second child, I think, really was at high risk, and no one did anything about it.
Well, I mean, what they did, which clearly didn't work, was they prayed on it.
Right. And prayer is fine, I think. But in the case of bacterial pneumonia, you need to do prayer and antibiotics.
Do you see this as abuse? Do you see it as neglect? How do you see this?
Yes, it's religiously motivated medical neglect that in this case twice resulted in death. I think that there are countries where this doesn't happen. This doesn't happen in Canada. It doesn't happen in England, for the simple reason that if you are found to medically neglect your child like this, then you go to jail and you lose your children. And that has been a real disincentive for this kind of faith healing. But here in the United States, we tolerate it.
Why? I mean, we do have this separation of church and state. Do you think that's part of it?
Well, I mean, while it's true that the First Amendment says that you are not allowed to – the Congress is not allowed to make any laws regarding the practice or expression of religion. The fact of the matter is we do make laws regarding that. I mean, you're not allowed to deny your child a life-saving blood transfusion if you're a Jehovah's Witness. You're not allowed to smoke peyote as part of the Native American church. If it violates local drug laws, peyote has mescaline. So we do have certain rules and I think it's a shame actually that we don't also do the same thing. I think if a case ever went to the Supreme Court, a faith healing case ever went to the Supreme Court, I'd like to believe that under the 14th Amendment, which calls for equal protection under the law, that children would be protected even from parents who have these unusual beliefs that tell them that you should pray instead of giving antibiotics for meningitis.
How would you, though, suggest convincing someone, you know, someone who deeply believes perhaps, you know, that God will intervene, God will save their child from bacterial meningitis? How do you convince them otherwise? I mean, if they were sitting in front of you, what could you say to them? You think that where they would say, oh, you're right, Dr. Offit, I think we should vaccinate or we should go to the emergency room?
I don't think I can. I think what happens is it's a legislative fix. And I think in this country, in England, and also in this country which followed British law, we did make it so that you weren't allowed to medically neglect your children in the name of God up until the mid-1970s. And then what happened is, ironically, in the name of trying to prevent and treat child abuse, the Nixon administration passed CAPTA, which is the Child Abuse Protection and Treatment Act. The problem was that there were two prominent Christian scientists in that administration that saw that there was about to be an uncomfortable light that was about to be shown on their religion. And so they said, no state can get this money, and it was a lot of money, unless you have a religious exemption to child abuse and neglect laws in that state. And so all 50 states passed that law. These two men ultimately, interestingly, went to jail for their role in Watergate.
We're talking about Ehrlichman and Haldeman.
That's who we're talking about, exactly.
And they put in these religious / philosophical exemptions?
Well, no, what they put in was a religious exemption to any child abuse and neglect law, which would include, for example, any medical neglect.
And both of them Christian scientists.
That's correct. And interestingly, Haldeman kept his Christian Science faith to the end, even when he had a severe and ultimately fatal disease. He chose prayer instead of medicine, but not Ehrlichman. Ehrlichman had diabetes and ultimately had a chronic peritoneal dialysis for that diabetes. So he chose medicine, even though, frankly, he allowed it to be denied by the law that he helped pass.
We're really talking about children here. So, I mean, do you care what adults do to themselves? I mean, if they have a belief system and they don't want to get any kind of treatment – do you essentially say you're an adult, you can decide for yourself, but children are different?
Yes. I think there was a 1944 Supreme Court ruling that said exactly that. It was the Prince v. Massachusetts ruling, which stated, while you are at liberty to martyr yourself to your religion, you are not at liberty to martyr your child to your religion. I think that makes sense.
Interesting you use the martyr word, because going back to this 81 or 91?
91, the measles epidemic.
The church actually asked the ACLU to get involved to, well, I guess, defend their right to not vaccinate or not deal with this medical crisis. The ACLU turned them down.
amazing. When you consider the fact, first of all, that there was a religious exemption to vaccination that had been on the books in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania for 10 years, so that legally, technically, those two churches could choose not to vaccinate on the basis of their religion. But the ACLU turned them down, and the reason was is you had to be here for that. This city was in a panic. I mean, people were scared to death of getting measles, and there was little sympathy for the churches who had put not only their children at risk, but those with whom their children came in contact at risk.
In fact, they said you have no right to martyr your kids.
That's
I don't
right.
know if I'm quoting you or quoting them.
No, you're quoting actually Deborah Levy from the Pennsylvania chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, who I think, frankly, was quoting that 1944 Supreme Court ruling because it was the wording was almost exact.
You have a section in here about some moils. This is used for circumcision, and you have raised some questions about a certain kind of practice. Describe that for our listeners.
Right. So for the ultra-Orthodox Jewish groups, there is a religious ritual called mitzitza bepeh, which literally means sucking with the mouth, which is to say that when you do the circumcision, when you make a cut and create a wound, that rather than cleaning off that wound with, say, sterile gauze, you clean it off by sucking the wound with your mouth. Now, if you have herpes simplex virus in your mouth, which can occur asymptomatically, you may not even know you're shedding herpes virus, the child can then get herpes, and that's happened. There have been 14 children who have suffered permanent disability, specifically brain damage, or died from herpes because of this procedure. It's primitive nonsense, and in a better world, it would be outlawed.
You describe talking to a group of sounds like Jewish religious leaders, kind of describing why this process is a risky thing. They seem to agree with you, but then they didn't want to change their ritual.
It's interesting. I gave a talk actually to about 30 pediatricians in the Lakewood, New Jersey area, where there's a large concentration of ultra-Orthodox Jews, and these were very smart men and women who were men and women of medicine, and they asked great questions about vaccines. But at the end, I asked them, so how do you tolerate this procedure, which is done, it sounds like, on about 90% of the children who follow this faith in Lakewood, New Jersey. And one of the physicians said to me, well, I mean, all medical procedures have side effects, but this is not a medical procedure. It's a religious ritual. If it were a medical procedure, it would be done the safest way possible, which is to say wipe off the wound with sterile gauze.
We're almost up in a break here. As you say, I mean, in many ways, from your perspective, the courts or the government needs to get involved. But what is the answer to that? I mean, on a sort of human level, what's the answer to that comment?
The answer to the comment from the doctor is this is not a medical procedure. It's a religious ritual. And I think in a better world, this would not be an issue. I think we would follow Canadian and British law and, frankly, not allow the folks to sacrifice their children in the name of their religion. I think if we had a religion, for example, who had as a basic tenet child sacrifice, we wouldn't allow that. Yet here, when we know that there are groups out there, like the followers of Christ Church in Idaho, for example, who are not going to be giving their children antibiotics if they have meningitis, they're not going to be giving them anti-seizure medicines if they have epilepsy, we allow that to happen up to the point that there's a death. And then we sort of have probation and ask these parents not to do it again until they do it again. It's absurd.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Dr. Paul Offit in this hour of Radio Times. He has a new book. It's called Bad Faith, and it's subtitled When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. Much more after this very short break, including a question from the book, What Would Jesus Do? Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Paul Offit. He's a professor of pediatrics in the Division of Infectious Disease at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where he's also director of Vaccine Education Center. And he has been a guest in the past on Radio Times talking about medicine and vaccines. He has a new book. It's called Bad Faith, When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. And that's what we're talking about on Radio Times. You have an interesting section in here. I mean, essentially, it is what would Jesus do? And you talk about the time of when Jesus lived, that children were property. They were barely sort of acknowledged in terms of having any kind of humanity, and that Jesus in many ways changed that.
Yes, that was sort of the surprising part for me. I mean, independent of, I guess, whether you believe in the existence of a supreme being or you believe that Jesus was the Son of God or you believe that the four Gospels that made it into the final canon are an accurate representation of his life and work, you have to be impressed by the figure described as Jesus of Nazareth, because at the time of his life, which was roughly, 4 BC to 30 AD, child abuse was the crying vice of the Roman Empire. I mean, infanticide was common, abandonment was common, children were property no different than slaves, and that was not Jesus. He stood up for children, right? Suffer me the children, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs. Although my favorite line is Matthew 25:40, where verily I say unto you, what you do unto one of the least of my brethren, you do unto me. A phrase that I think you could emblazon onto the entranceways of every children's hospital in the world. He stood up for children. So when, for example, in 1991, when we all lived through that measles epidemic here in Philadelphia, parents said, Jesus was my doctor. I just think it's sort of directly contrary to what he stood for, at least as represented in the New Testament.
I mean, it's a different kind of Jesus that you're describing, or it's perhaps they haven't even thought of that kind of Jesus. I mean, you're saying that, in many ways, Jesus, if he had children, he would have vaccinated his children. He would take them to the hospital if they were ill.
Based on his the degree to which he cared for children, I can only imagine that that's what would have happened. And to be honest with you, when this was all going down in Philadelphia and we were in a panic, it would have been helpful, actually, if prominent members of the Christian community stood up and said, look, this isn't us. The choice to put your children to unnecessary risk is an unchristian thing to do. That would have helped.
But I would say that most people who are people of faith are also people who believe in science and probably believe in medicine as well. We really are talking about, in many ways, people on the fringes, on the edges of a lot of religions or even cults.
I completely agree, which is why I think it would be nice if we all stood up and said that when people put children in harm's way in the name of religion, that it's not a religious act and that it shouldn't be given the legal protections of religion.
It's interesting, though, because as you well know from the anti-vaccine people, not all of them are religious. In many ways, some of them are libertarians. They don't want government or outside people telling them what to do. Some are, I think, very secular, probably come to their beliefs based on things that they have read that raise questions for them about things like vaccines. So they're not necessarily deeply religious people.
No, I mean, I think there's a libertarian streak that runs throughout American jurisprudence. We don't like to be told what to do. We certainly don't like to be told how to raise our families. I mean, probably best exemplified by Rand Paul's recent statement when he said that, the government doesn't own their children. Parents own their children. Actually, that's not correct. Parents don't own their children. They have a certain responsibility to care for them. And should they put them in harm's way unnecessarily, sometimes the state can rightfully step in. So I think We have to stand up for children here.
But does that mean that if a parent says, I'm not going to have my child vaccinated, we should have the state step in and take that child away from them?
Right. This probably isn't going to lessen my hate mail, but here's what I would say. I think that there certainly is a constitutional right not to vaccinate a child who has a medical exemption to vaccination, whether because they're allergic to a specific component, because they're immune compromised, whatever reason. There is no constitutional right, actually, to religious or philosophical exemptions. Those are political decisions made by the state. And I think they're bad ones. So, first of all, as I said earlier, I think that it's an unreligious act to put your child in harm's way. And secondly, philosophical, really? I mean, philo, love, sophos, wisdom. Where's the wisdom that says it's better not to get a vaccine than get one? What these are, this represents through the actions of parents who fear vaccines, usually for things that have nothing to do with vaccines, that vaccines cause autism or allergies or diabetes. I mean, those are not consequences of vaccination, and so they don't want to be forced to get them. But you get to the point where individual autonomy trumps societal good. I mean, Philadelphia in 1991, that was an example. There were not only those children in those church communities that died, but children in surrounding communities that died. So it is a tragedy of the commons.
Has any child ever been vaccinated against their parents' wishes?
Once, Philadelphia, 1991. I mean, it's the only time I think we've ever had compulsory vaccination, which is to say those children were taken against their parents' will and vaccinated because things were that bad. And although it sounds ridiculous now, but looking back on it, if you were there at the time, you would have understood it.
Let me quote something from the book, because I think this kind of encapsulates where you stand. You say, today, parents in Pennsylvania can be sent to prison if they unreasonably restrain a child, or if they drive a child while under the influence of alcohol, if they cause a child to be near a methamphetamine lab, or if they slap or shake a baby. But if they withhold life-saving medicines and do it in the name of God, the odds are they'll never spend a day in jail. Parents can still claim a religious motive for this most unreligious act.
That's right. But because of what Ehrlichman and Halderman did in the mid-1970s, at the time there were 50 states that had religious exemptions to child abuse and neglect laws. Now there are 44, but you know, and this certainly, ours is one of them. Pennsylvania is one of them. And I think if we're going to really stand up for children, we would eliminate these exemptions, because they don't make sense and they certainly put children in harm's way.
Earlier this year, there was this measles outbreak. Do you think it's an event like that that can get people to rethink some of these exemptions?
I think that's happened. I think it was a tipping point. It's interesting. Last year, there were about 645 cases of measles in the United States. But the bulk of it, of that 380 cases, were in an Amish community in Ohio, and nobody cared. The media didn't pay attention. The public didn't pay attention, because I think they saw that Amish community as insular, as other. But when you had an outbreak that centered on Disneyland, and now that it's involved 17 states and about 175 children, people saw that as us. I mean, this was a common space. It was a shared space. Suddenly, Minnie Mouse's spots on her dress had new significance. And, you know, and people were angry. I think it was a tipping point. I've never seen parents actually so angry at other parents who are choosing not only to expose their own children, but other children with whom they come in contact at risk. We'll see whether it lasts, but there are many states now that are reconsidering their philosophical exemptions because of this particular measles outbreak.
Let me ask about another family that you write about in this book. This is Rita and Doug Swan. They were Christian scientists. They used prayer to heal number of, I guess, medical situations. What happened to them?
Yeah, Rita is to me an unlikely hero in this book. She her son Matthew, who was about a year and a half old, had bacterial meningitis, specifically with a bacteria called Haemophilus influenza type B. She chose prayer instead of antibiotics, and over a 12-day period, he suffered and ultimately died because of that choice. And then, unlike every other faith-healing parent, she sort of turned around. She said, I have been duped. I've been my belief in Christian Science was, at best, in her words, a fragile magic. She went on the Phil Donahue show and was the first person, I think, ever to call a major religion a fraud. And she then became a vigorous activist to overturn these laws that had been put in place because of what Halderman and Ehrlichman had done. And what she did that made her so brave to me is that, unlike other faith-healing parents who invariably say things like, look, this was God's will, I guess I just wasn't faithful enough, she said, essentially, I let my child die unnecessarily. This was my fault. And I now have come to believe that no God would let someone put mm-hmm. their child in this situation where they could suffer or die, and so I'm out.
In fact, she found what she considered to be more than 100, almost 200 children who died because of their parents' religious beliefs.
That's right. She worked with a pediatrician named Seth Asser, published a paper in Pediatrics in 1998 that really identified the roughly 25 faith-healing groups in this country that allow this to happen, and found all these sort of hidden deaths and uncovered really a cemetery in Idaho associated with the Followers of Christ Church that looked like it had been transported from the 1700s into the 21st century because there were so many children's graves.
What's your faith?
I was raised Jewish. My father was a deeply religious man, as is my sister and brother. I'm not particularly religious.
But did you think about your own faith as you were writing this book called Bad Faith?
Not really. What I thought about was in reading the New Testament sort of from front to back was how can parents use this text to say things like, Jesus was my doctor. That's really how I sort of – so I did. I mean, I when I first started this book, I assumed that I would take the sort of Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris's atheistic, you know, religion is illogical and potentially harmful. I didn't end up there. I ended up – actually, I guess it's like the story of the man who goes to church to find God, but finds religion instead. I mean, I found excellent, you know, just stories that were deeply spiritual and religious and moving and made me wonder how anybody can put their children in harm's way after reading this book.
And that's Paul Offit. The book is called Bad Faith: When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. We have a lot of people who want to join our conversation. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read an email from Pamela. She says, perhaps you could say this to those parents. God allowed us to gain the knowledge to understand this disease and the means to combat it. Therefore, it is an answer to a prayer and should be embraced as a gift from God.
Right. I completely agree. And actually, there's a quote from Galileo that's very similar to that, which is, I can't believe that the same God who granted us a sense and reason and intellect also intended us to forgo their use.
Mm. But are we, if we're talking about faith healers, and I don't want to make, you know, broad stereotype generalizations about faith healers, but I'm assuming they don't necessarily live in the sort of modern world that I think most people do. It's a more fundamentalist, more rooted in probably old beliefs than current, the sort of current world that we live in. I'm stumbling here for words.
It's a spectrum. So for example, you take somebody like Rita Swan. Rita Swan is brilliant. She got a PhD from Vanderbilt in English. Her thesis was on Percy Shelley and British Romantic poetry, and yet still she chose to watch her child die. And I spent a lot of time with her on the phone, and she, when asked the question, how could you let this happen, she said, you really can't understand how little I understood about medicine. I didn't even know that I didn't grow up with a thermometer. My parents were Christian scientists. I didn't even know that a fever could mean infection. But then you'll have somebody like a guy named Larry Parker, who I also talked to for this book, who was a member of a mainstream community. He was actually very medically sophisticated. His child had type 1 diabetes. He'd been giving his child insulin since the child was much younger. He knew what it could mean to not have enough insulin or have too much insulin. He was very medically sophisticated. And then he just decided that he was going to pray and hope that his child's diabetes would be cured until he died. It's interesting. There are a lot of reasons for why people make these choices. It's a spectrum.
But are you asking people to be rational?
I don't think that's possible. I think what you have to do – I mean, I would argue that Larry Parker at some level was psychotic. That when you know, he prayed for his child to leave when the diabetes didn't resolve with prayer and his child died, he hoped that his child would be resurrected during the funeral service. When that didn't happen, he hoped that the child would be resurrected 4 days after the child had been buried, much as Jesus had been resurrected according to the New Testament. None of that happened. I mean, I would argue those are delusional acts and psychotic. I think the answer is these are legislative fixes. I think it has to be made very clear that if you make these kind of choices, you risk jail and losing your children.
But do you think these people love their children?
Yes, I very much do. And I think if you ask them the question, how could you let this child go untreated, they would argue they were treating them. They were treating them by prayer.
Right. Which makes it complicated, right? I mean, oftentimes with neglect and abuse, it's because parents don't love their children, well, either don't know how to love their children or don't love their children, and they are, you know, horribly abusive to their children.
Right. That's not this. These parents deeply love their children, which is why, for example, in the state of Oregon recently, there was a change in legislation such that if you are found to have medically neglected your children, you're going to jail and your children will be put in foster homes. And that changed behavior among the followers of Christ Church that stayed there. Some of them decided to go to Utah or to Idaho, rather, where there was more liberty to do what they were doing. But legislative fixes work.
Let me see what Keith from Princeton has to say. Keith, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I wanted to offer a little food for thought on this topic is that I entered the field of public health as an inspector in 2007, and I was working for a county agency at the time. And at the time, the mindset was that we as inspectors had we can use our proper judgment to decide whether or not a family was claiming a religious exemption legitimately or whether they were just claiming it because they didn't want to have the vaccine. Hmm. And the guidance we got from our superiors were that if a family was claiming religious exemption and we didn't feel that they were actually having that exemption due to their real beliefs and their real faith, we can exclude the child from school until they had that vaccine.
Interesting.
And you know, reasonably, it's because, you know, it's protective for other children. If the kids that are supposed to have vaccines come to school with the proper protections. Now, in 2008, that mindset had changed simply because there were some parents that were complaining and saying, you know, it's our religious exemption right to say that we don't want to do vaccines and we should be able to have that right. And so from 2007 to 2008, the mindset changed, and then we were told, do not enforce this law using your judgment. If someone writes down on a paper napkin that they want a religious exemption, then that's perfectly fine. We'll accept that, and they don't have to have their child come to school with the vaccine.
Well, Keith,
prior to that, it
sure
would have to be a
uh-huh. No. You raise a really interesting point, and the fact that we're hearing from an inspector, Paul Offit, your thoughts.
Yeah, I guess I have trouble buying into the notion of religious exemptions of vaccination. First of all, the first vaccine was invented in 1796 by Edward Jenner, the smallpox vaccine. The Old Testament was written between 1400 and 400 BC, never mentions vaccines. The New Testament around 100 AD never mentions vaccines. The Quran around 600 AD never mentions vaccines. So I think it's I just see it as a straw man. I know that when people say, this is my religion, this is how mm-hmm. I practice my faith, everybody stands back. And I think knowing that everybody's going to stand back, this has been used. But again, I would argue that it is not your constitutional right to religiously exempt yourself from vaccination. So I wish we would just eliminate these exemptions because they don't make a bit of sense.
But I'm also thinking about, Keith, going into someone's house and deciding whether they are religious enough in order to have this religious exemption.
No,
I mean, that makes me a little uncomfortable.
Right. Well, we sort of came up against this at some level at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia when in 2009 we basically mandated a flu vaccine, which is to say that if you were going to be a healthcare worker in our hospital, if you were going to take on the responsibility of being a healthcare worker, then it wasn't your inalienable right to catch and transmit influenza in that hospital. And so we didn't accept, obviously, philosophical exemptions. We would have accepted a religious exemption. And so what we did that first year was we said that you had to provide a letter from your cleric saying where in the text of your major religion it says that you shouldn't be vaccinated. Got a lot of notes from yoga instructors, but that didn't count.
Oh, very interesting. I mean, sort of saying go to the source, quote the source, and then we will consider a religious exemption. That's Paul Offit, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. He has a new book. It's called Bad Faith: When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. He's also a professor of pediatrics in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where he is director of the Vaccine Education Center. Looks like we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Not surprised. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. In his new book, Bad Faith: When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine, our guest pediatrician and infectious disease specialist at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, Paul Offit, explores the motivations and decisions of people who choose to forego modern medicine in favor of using their faith to fight life-threatening illnesses, including curable illnesses. Offit has been on the front lines. An advocate for the vaccination of children, has written extensively on this subject, and that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. Let me get Arnold from North Philadelphia to join us. Arnold, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up the very common in this area issue of deliverance healing. People foregoing their mental health treatment for schizophrenia and other very dangerous diseases and getting cured by, well, what amounts to an exorcism, mm-hmm. believing they're cured by these pastors who supposedly are shepherds. And then they forego their medicine, and then terrible things happen, like has happened in a case I know of. They set fire to their car in front of a police station because they felt it was a foreign attack.
Or a sign of God or something like that. Arnold, you, Paul, write about exorcism in this book.
Right. I have a chapter on exorcism, which still, interestingly, is practiced at some level by the Catholic Church. There was actually a seminar in Baltimore in 2005. About 100 priests and bishops showed up to try and learn how to best remove spirits from people's bodies. It's funny. I actually don't have a problem with that per se, in the sense that if someone is having an acute psychotic break, I think if they or their family feels better that this is done, that's fine, as long as they also give the antipsychotic meds as well. Because I think, you know, priests can certainly be very comforting, and this may make one feel better, but do that and give the antipsychotic meds.
You wrote a book called Do You Believe in Magic? It looked at the sort of alternative medicine world. Do you see some parallels between that and this world that we're talking about now?
Yes. In both cases, I think there are belief systems that aren't based on evidence. So, for example, if you go into your GNC center and you see this magical world of medicines that are going to reduce stress and boost energy and support prostate health and joint health, realize that there are essentially no data to support those claims, but we believe in it. And there is a placebo response, which is physiological, that's of value, which is fine to a point. And obviously, regarding the stuff I'm talking about in this book, that point is when children are unnecessarily put in harm's way.
We do hear stories about what could be described as unexplained recoveries. I mean, people that have life-threatening illnesses and they get better. And sometimes it doesn't feel like you know why they get better. What do you think of things like that?
Yeah, I think so, for example, if you have pancreatic cancer, specifically adenocarcinoma, that's for the most part a death sentence. Medicine hasn't caught up to that, or to glioblastomas or brainstem gliomas, you know, sort of brain cancers. But there are those people, and it probably represents, you know, less than 0.5 or 0.1% who do recover. And I guess I don't see that as a miracle. I just see that as the fact that there's a bell-shaped curve and you're just looking at one part of that bell-shaped curve.
You have I'm assuming you work with medical students, and part of this education center, part of them is educating them to educate parents about medical treatment. What are some of the exercises that you put them through to help them have a relationship, deal with some of these questions, and get people to make the right decision from their perspective?
Right. Well, my interaction with medical students is primarily in the area of vaccines, and I pretend with the students to be someone who is violently opposed to vaccines, and I ask them
like
all
the questions.
That's role playing. That's what I do. It's fun.
I mean, the idea of, I guess, challenging them to make them come back with some kind of explanation that will convince somebody.
Right. And that's right. Not only that, but also one to have the information in hand to answer questions about, you know, do vaccines contain toxins or harmful additives or manufacturing residuals? I mean, to be able to at least arm them with that information, but also to sort of get them to be advocates for children.
And that role playing, does that come easily to you only because you know the arguments against vaccines so well?
It's actually much easier to be on that side
of
things than the other side. Yeah, sure. No, it's actually fun.
Let me see what Bill from Germantown has to say. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I'm Bill King, a local pediatrician here in West Philly.
Yeah.
And we just sent Dr. Offit a letter just this morning, because we've changed our policy for vaccinations, where you know, families have to routinely vaccinate or leave the practice.
Huh.
And just about half an hour ago, we just had our first family walk out with five kids. It's going to be a big financial loss to us to have them leave. But the dad walked out because he brought a sports form, and we don't clear children for sports if they're not fully vaccinated.
Interesting. And Bill, why have you changed? I assume this is a change policy for your practice?
Yeah. Yeah, well, we got to see, you know, we've always, you know, had trouble with the personal belief exemption. And we, you know, I spent a lot of breath arguing with families about that is not a religious belief. What religion are you talking about?
Huh.
But in this case, the other families in the practice are very alarmed about the idea of people coming in who could be contagious for measles because they're unvaccinated, and they're, you know, they don't expect when they come in for a well checkup with their baby that there's another person sitting in the waiting room who's going to get checked for measles who hasn't been vaccinated. So we've now decided that it's the risk of losing other families in the practice is higher than that one family's personal belief believing that it's okay to be contagious for measles when you could have done something about it.
Interesting. Bill, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Is that, Paul, anything you want to say in response?
Yeah, I think that the practitioner on the front lines is in a tough spot. I mean, on the one hand, if you choose not to see those children, then you're the child's advocate. Your job is to try and do the best you can to get that child the things that put them in the safest position possible, and that's what vaccines do. If you send them out of your office, then what happens? Do they just go to a chiropractor who's perfectly willing not to vaccinate them, or another doctor who's perfectly willing not to vaccinate them? On the other hand, by continuing to see them, as you said, you do have some responsibility to your waiting room, knowing that there are children in that waiting room who may not be able to be vaccinated because they're getting steroids for their asthma or for other they're chronically infected with, or they're immune compromised, whatever the reason. So do you have a responsibility to your waiting room? You do. I think my advice to pediatricians is to be passionate. I mean, to say, let me love your child. Don't put me in a position where you're asking me to send them out into a world that's becoming progressively more dangerous with more measles, more whooping cough, more mumps. Please don't put me in that position. Please don't ask me to practice substandard care. It's okay to be passionate, but I think that's the best you can do.
Passionate meaning using that kind of language about let me love your child.
Right. So you establish the fact that you're both on the same side, is that you both care about that child and want what's best for them.
Your book is full of stories. One of them about it's a Catholic hospital in Phoenix, and its director was excommunicated by the Catholic Church. The church cut ties with the Catholic hospital there. What were the circumstances?
Right. This was probably the most difficult chapter for me to write, was the chapter on abortion. I call that chapter the dialogue of the deaf, because neither side seems to be able to hear the other. But I think there's one situation where it's quite clear, and that's where a woman who is pregnant her life is in danger. In this case of the archdiocese in the hospital in Phoenix, the woman had something called pulmonary hypertension because of her pregnancy. If she had continued in that pregnancy, she was going to die. And because she was so early in her pregnancy, the unborn child was also going to die. So basically, that hospital had the choice of saving one life or none. The mother also had four other children. The hospital correctly chose to save the mother's life, but the archdiocese of Phoenix excommunicated the woman, Mary McBride, who had made that decision in the hospital, and they also wouldn't allow the hospital anymore to perform a sacrament. To perform duties associated with Catholicism. It was just ridiculous. I think there the situation is easy. You can talk endlessly about the rights of the unborn child versus the rights of the mother. Do we rate a mother who an actual life? How do we compare that to a potential life? That's sort of an unending discussion and not a clear one. But this is clear. If the woman's life is in danger, save her life, because otherwise you lose two lives.
And why was that a hard chapter for you to write? Just because it's abortion and
right,
families and
– Right. The discussion of sort of when does life begin? I mean, what is the relative value of a potential life versus life? I mean, although I'm pro-choice, you certainly can't deny the fact that when a sperm fertilizes an egg, that now fertilized egg has a full complement of human genetic material and has the capacity to be a long-lived, happy, healthy, productive life. You can't deny that. And so I can understand at some level people's feelings about abortion. So I took the easy way out in some ways by just picking the situations that I think are easiest. And it still surprised me that the Catholic Church often doesn't stand up for the mother in that situation where her life is in danger.
You also throw in the Hobby Lobby decision here as well. And you say, although executives at Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood Specialties had argued that IUDs and the Plan B morning after pill induce abortions, they don't. According to research from the Mayo Clinic, National Institutes of Health, and other academic centers, both of these contraceptive devices prevent fertilization, not implantation. This gets, again, a bit into the weeds, but very significant and important weeds. And I wonder just sort of how much people don't understand about science and medicine complicates decisions, policies, even Supreme Court decisions.
Right. And in this case, just have sort of an uncomfortable entrance of people's religious beliefs into how they're going to handle the health care of people who work for them, many of whom obviously aren't going to have those same beliefs.
Let me see what Tina from Nazareth has to say. Tina, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi, Tina. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just was curious as to wondering why I've noticed on your shows that it's always been coming from the perspective of this universities and the pro-vaccination. I've never really heard a whole lot of information from lots of other perspectives, like to say, you know, there's a lot of epidemics of death every day from all different autoimmune diseases and many diseases and viruses, but it seems to be like this real simple focus on measles and then the religious aspect of it, where it's like, that's just assuming that vaccination is the best medical practice. So it's like there's no other argument to say, well, let's look at other alternatives. I mean, what about the immune system and working with holistic healing and nutrition and all these other aspects of it? It just seems like it's so narrowed into this one focus that nobody has any other information to talk about. It's just we're only hearing it from the university saying, this is it, this is the best practice, this is what you have to do, and that's it. And then they'll go, well, there's these extremists that are really religious that say we're doing it because, you know, God tells us to, or whatever the story is. But there's a whole bunch of other people in between. And I just am surprised I haven't heard on NPR, you know, debates like that, where it just seems like every time I turn on, it's pro-vaccination.
Well, no, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And I'll be honest with you, Tina, back in the days when there were questions about the safety and health of vaccines, we did have those shows where we hosted debates. And now you're absolutely right. We approach this from the perspective in many ways that we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. And that's based on a lot of the science and research that we have done and have essentially come to the conclusion, yes, there are potential, some small potential risks with vaccinations, but there are much bigger risks for children who are not vaccinated. Just to explain our perspective on Radio Times, but let me give Paul Offit a chance to respond.
It's interesting. I mean, it's really not debatable. I mean, it doesn't matter what I say. It doesn't matter what people who come on to this show who would say that vaccines cause autism say. The only thing that matters is what the data show. And the data are overwhelming that vaccines are safe and effective. So I applaud NPR for sticking to the data. I mean, vaccine, you know, sometimes people will say to me, how do I get people to believe in vaccines? Vaccines aren't a belief system. They're an evidence-based system, and they stand on a mountain of evidence.
Tina, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We have an email from Drew. He says, at what level of government or governments does Dr. Offit feel is best suited to put forward appropriate legislation? I mean, is it a state-by-state approach from your perspective?
Yeah. So religious and philosophical exemptions were put in place at the state level. They were political decisions. And I think if they're going to be taken out of place, then that's going to have to be state by state. I watch Rita Swan, who's now a woman in her 70s, you know, go from state to state trying to overturn these religious exemptions to child abuse and neglect laws. And that's what it's going to take. She's remarkable to me, actually. And I think, you know, she's trying to exorcise, in a sense, the demons that were created when she watched her son die needlessly. And I think it's a hole that was created that will never be filled. But she to me is a hero because, in fact, frankly, all the proceeds from all my royalties from the sale of this book are going to her organization, which is Children's Healthcare as a Legal Duty or Child. Hmm.
I'm also curious about, whether you're going to write another book in 3 years, sort of essentially on the same issue. Do you feel like you have exhausted this issue from the multiple perspectives that you've looked at it?
I guess we'll see how it plays out. I mean, the book just came out, so I'll see what kind of feedback I get. And if there is sort of a sequel to this based on the feedback, sure.
Mm. And, I mean, do you still get a lot of criticism? We heard from Tina, and she obviously doesn't agree with what we've been talking about in this hour, but do you still get a lot of criticism?
Well, yeah, I get the occasional negative mail. I you know, but mostly it's positive. I think most people, you know, like me, care about children and want good things to happen to them. But there are, you know, but I think the minute that you sort of attack someone's religion and in a sense the false belief that vaccines are doing more harm than good is in a sense has all the mm-hmm. power and emotion of religion, you know, you're going to get negative feedback.
And do you think if measles does make a return, I mean, that people will begin to fear measles more and that can be an effort to try to get people to vaccinate their children?
Well, that's happened with this current outbreak. I mean, there are many states that now are looking to overturn their philosophical exemption to vaccination. The question is how long it'll last. I mean, if this burns, this outbreak, hopefully it will burn out. Hopefully that we will have learned from this. But I hope it doesn't take more than that. We really have to let these diseases come back and watch children suffer and be hospitalized. Unfortunately, not die yet from measles, but, you know, could if we get to a few thousand cases. Do we really have to sort of resort to this kind of child sacrifice to get our attention here?
Paul Offit, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The book is called Bad Faith: When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm sure there's a conversation taking place on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter, and you can download a podcast of the program. Kevin Griffin and Diana Martinez, the engineers for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens with Quinn Lipson. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for your phone calls, and thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.